Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealth.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Environment and Natural Resources Forum. I will be your chair for tonight's program. It is now my honor to introduce the people who will talk with us tonight and also help us understand the dilemmas that face the communities that endure coal mining in their communities. It's also my honor to introduce Patricia Adams, who will be our moderator. And I'm sorry that we don't have name cards for you, but just so everyone will remember, this is Patricia. And next to Patricia is Jen Gilliman, who's one of our filmmakers, and then Sally Rubin, also one of our filmmakers. Patricia is a founding member of the Land Trust for the Little Tennessee and Macomb County, North Carolina. She is here tonight because the horror of mountaintop removal is an issue that's close to her heart. A wonderful writer and dedicated environmentalist and teacher, Patricia partnered with her husband, John Adams, founding director of the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC. Today, she and John are writing a book on the history of NRDC. Patricia's writing includes her travels to such places as Alaska, the Amazon, and China. She has a weekly famous writers program on an NPR radio affiliate program in upstate New York. What I treasure about Patricia's writing is that she takes us beyond the words that I use all the time, such as environment, energy, global warming, words in some ways that have drifted into becoming almost slogans or buzzwords, and sometimes advertisements even to sell products and services. Patricia's great gift to me is to bring us into the heart of all the worlds behind the environmental words. She touches our personal everyday lives and meanings, what happens in our experiences of the worlds we live in. She reaches our core of being human. She reaches our hearts. I shall always remember her essay, Firsthand, about the Southern Appalachian Mountains, where she and John built a cabin on the land her family has owned for 7 generations. This writings and other writings can be found on the BioGems linked on the NRDC website. People, their mountains, their land, air, water, their families, and children are sacred for Patricia and for John, and they have lived their lives dedicated to protecting and caretaking all things great and small. Patricia tonight will introduce our filmmakers and then help lead us in a discussion of the work that we will see and have reviewed. Please welcome Patricia Adams, writer and environmentalist. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann Clark, for arranging this event and for your continuing support for the work that is being done to address these issues. As John and I were writing the book that Ann mentioned on the history of NRDC, I was researching a case that had to do with mining and came across a logo for a mining company that said it was bringing the Earth's resources to life. I was struck by this idea, the Earth's resources to life. Now, to mine the Earth's resources of fossil fuels, which have been held within the Earth for millions of years, means that we have to extract them by drilling deep into the Earth, by pulling the resources up with pumps and massive machines, or by pushing aside vast, deep sections of the Earth's surface. We extract oil, gas, and coal this way, and once we extract them, we burn them to create energy. Then we send the residue from this burning into the atmosphere. And in terms of mountaintop removal, 1.8 trillion tons of CO2 will be sent into the atmosphere by burning the coal from mountaintop removal alone. All this will eventually warm the Earth to the point that the human race will be unable to exist here. This does not even address the impact on human resources of the people who live in these areas that are so impacted. Is this bringing the Earth's resources to life? There's something wrong with this picture. This big picture must be addressed, and this is why mountaintop removal is not just a regional issue in the southern Appalachians, a place that some argue should just be a sacrifice zone in order for us to meet our energy needs. Mountaintop removal is something we all need to know about and act upon because it is a major factor in the global problem of energy production. The desecration of these mountains, which includes destroying communities, clear-cutting forests, burying streams, poisoning the air and water, is emblematic of what is happening all over the globe as we extract more and more fossil fuels to use for energy. This is why Sally Rubin and Jen Gilliman's film, which they co-directed and co-produced, is so important for all of us. We can read and hear about mountaintop removal, but it must be presented visually in order to really understand its impact. When John and I visited West Virginia with NRDC's team, Alan Hershkowitz and Rob Perks, it wasn't until we flew over the mountains that we realized the extent of the destruction. Riding on the highways and visiting the villages, everything's sort of hidden back in the hills, and it's hard to get there and see what is actually happening. And you heard people in this film say over and over, "I had no idea." This evening, we will have more than an idea about what is happening to our Earth in the mountaintop removals. I want to briefly tell you about Jen and Sally. Jen Gilliman is a lead developer of strategic initiatives at the Bay Area Video Coalition. She works with the public media and community organizations in developing storytelling programs, next-generation internet coalitions with interactive websites, and develops partnerships with independent producers and nonprofit organizations. She is an expert in the use of new and developing media, which is important with the virtual mountain mine of video scheme. You'll have to explain it because I don't totally understand what it is, but you all both will explain it this evening, I'm sure. Sally Rubin, whose family comes from Tennessee, is a documentary filmmaker, editor, and professor based in Los Angeles. I only learned when I read her short bio that she produced with David Sutherland, who also co-produced Deep Down, a movie, Country Boys, which I happened to see one night literally surfing the TV, and it was on, not NPR, but BBS, I think, right? And this also was a film about boys growing up in Floyd County, Kentucky, where this film was made. And I was really impressed with this honest, non-didactic film about boys in this rural area, their dreams, their disappointments, the efforts of the adults and the teachers to help them. And I actually ordered it for our own rural school in upstate New York that the teachers could see it because I thought it was such an impressive movie. Sally has also produced films on the homeless, beer sales in Iraq, as well as producing a documentary on the 20-year history of NRDC in Los Angeles. Now, I would like now to get started by asking you to give a short synopsis of the film for our radio listeners and also tell us how you became interested in making this film.
Okay. First of all, thank you so much, Patricia. Thank you, everyone here, for coming out tonight, all the Commonwealth Club members, and especially everyone from the NRDC who's come. You know who you are. Thank you for making this possible. And thank you to Anne for absolutely everything that you've done. We're so happy to be here. And, you know, Jen and I believe probably many of you in this room just think that mountaintop removal and connecting to Appalachia are two extremely important issues. And to be here with this many people supporting the conversation about this is just really moving. So thank you. A couple just items of business before we launch into the synopsis. One is we've put out a contact info. Actually, we have a contact info board that we're passing around. If you'd like to be on our list, we'd love that, so feel free to sign up. And also, there are surveys for the Commonwealth Club. I think they're those blue sheets that are on your chairs, and we've been asked to request that you fill those out when you can. So, launching into the film for all the radio listeners, Deep Down is a story about two friends and their community in eastern Kentucky. It follows the story of this small community over a 2.5-year period as it struggles with mountaintop removal mining. In particular, the film focuses on Beverly May, an old-timey fiddler and nurse practitioner, and Terry Ratliff, a traditional Appalachian woodworker and chairmaker, as they go through their arcs their story arcs in figuring out what to do about the mining in their area. Beverly becomes a mountaintop removal mining activist and works hard to stop mining in her town, while Terry is approached by a coal mining company and has to decide whether or not to sign away land that has been in his family for over 200 years. So that's the sort of 25 words or less synopsis. I think in terms of, we wanted to start by sort of giving you some context for the film, how we came to the topic, and this is one of my favorite things to talk about. It sort of always feels like peeling away the layers of an onion. And I think talking about this sort of frames any conversation about the film and about mountaintop removal in a really interesting way, a way that I really like. So when we first started this project, this was actually almost 3 years ago now. I think it was March of 2000. It was even earlier. It was more like winter of 2006. Jen and I had met here in San Francisco and really hit it off. We were actually working on a film about a transgender bike messenger at that time. Jen was shooting it, and I was doing some editing on it. And we clicked, and we thought, well, one day let's do something together. So I moved to LA, and Jen lives here in San Francisco, and we contacted each other and thought, you know, it's time, let's do something. So we started batting around ideas, and I think at one point sort of doing something on socioeconomic class in America was at the forefront of both of our minds. And we thought, all right, cool, but how do we tell this story? And both of us had always been interested in Appalachia. Jen's from Peoria, Illinois, so a rural, more rural area than San Francisco at least, and part of my family is from East Tennessee. So we started focusing in on Appalachia, and we're sort of interested in the Tennessee Valley Authority, not sure. And one day I get an email from Jen, I'll never forget her words, which said, I got our idea. You'll never believe it. They're blowing off the tops of the mountains and putting them back. And I think at that time that must have meant reclamation. So immediately we thought, okay, this is probably going to be our topic. And we began calling around researching and found that, in fact, this would be the way to tell the story about classism and also environmental classism that we were interested in telling. And, you know, so we went down to Appalachia, began working with regional groups, especially the Kentuckians for the Commonwealth at that time, who took us around and introduced us to activists. And we met Beverly May actually first and were quite struck by her, the protagonist in the film. And soon she introduced us to her friend, Terry, and we began to realize that these two stories might offset each other in a really interesting way. And as we sort of delved, and we'll talk about this further over the next few minutes, but, you know, as we delved further and further into the story, we started to realize we wanted to tell a story that was not only two-sided, not just for the sake of even two-sidedness, but really something that was complex and rich and that you could really sink your teeth into, and a story that really got at human, universal issues around making hard decisions and sort of being a person that you can live with and being able to look yourself in the mirror every morning, a story of integrity. I always like using that word, integrity. So that's sort of what brought us to what you see here today. I think, I don't know, maybe that's all I'll say on that. We can talk a bit more later about the history of the project, and we'll go into timeline, but please feel free later to ask us any more questions about the project's development if you're curious.
Before we hear from Jen, I need to remind the radio audience that they are listening to the Commonwealth Club. And the program today is on Deep Down on Appalachia Coal Mining with Patricia Adams, Sally Rubin, and Jen Gelliman. And for our audience here present, you have question cards. And so, can everyone hear me? I'm sorry about that. So would you please, if you have a question for our panel, if you would fill it out and we will pick them up and bring them up to Patricia, and we will have a question period at the end of our presentation. So please feel free to do that, and we welcome questions very much. So, Jen, you're on now.
Okay. Did you want to ask me a question of some kind, or should I just launch in and say whatever I want? So I was asked to talk a little bit about the challenges that we faced in making this film, or I guess coming to the point we are now, which is not quite complete yet. We're in post-production. So one of the things early on that was both a challenge and kind of a blessing was that it took quite a while for us to try to build trust with people. you know, if you're from a small town or any place that feels a little bit isolated, and you have people coming in from the outside, particularly if those people ask a lot of questions, which we tend to do, mainly out of interest, but also just in our scouting for, we were in the story hunting phase, so you can picture us wandering around in these towns in Appalachia, trying to meet people and develop rapport with people. So that's one of the ways that it was challenging, but also a huge benefit to our film, because it really, we came to understand how people, why people were mistrustful, and the ways that the companies in some ways had made them distrustful, because people would get a contract slid across the coffee table that they would sign and then later realize what they had signed. And in some cases that was, they were signing away their land, or for a purpose that they didn't intend. And then, you know, we were outsiders. We were city slickers. I'm from San Francisco. Sally was coming from LA. So we spent a lot of time just hanging out with people, getting to know them. And before we'd turn on any camera or do any interviews, just really doing a lot of hanging out at the grocery stores, barbecues, churches. Sally dragged me into so many Baptist churches, way more than I ever thought I would go into. But we actually developed a lot of pretty great friendships, particularly in the community where we ended up working and spending the last 2.5 years. We have a friend there, Rick, who his trailer that he used to live in was basically damaged by the blasting, which was right next to his house. And over the years, he appears in the film a couple of times, but over the years, we watched the mining kind of creep in on him right next to his house. He had to move from one trailer to the other, but luckily he left the other trailer empty and he would let us stay there. He would put towels out there for us in the other trailer. We would hang out with him in his new trailer. But really it was that initial layer of trust that we built over a year, maybe even a year and a half, before we really got into it and felt like, okay, these folks get what we're trying to do. They know us when they see us. People wave to us. When we go to the meetings and things, we pretty much know everyone in the room. So that was especially challenging, I think, at first. Also, just in terms of the filmmaking side of things, just trying to navigate the narrative, particularly when it's this complex. You have this whole extractive industry layer, and then there's the federal law that can be changing from time to time. There's the state law, and then there's what's happening actually on the ground in this community. So trying to build in all of those elements into what will end up being just a one-hour film is an extremely challenging venture. I think we're still kind of learning that now that we're in the editing room and trying to get down smaller and smaller, but trying to communicate through film the idea that this is an extremely destructive thing, and it's gigantic, but it's also very small, and it can come down to individual personal decisions. That's something we're still trying to deal with as we edit the story.
Could I ask you something about the individual aspect of it and about Terry's decision?
Yeah.
This man was a holdout and wanting to keep his land separate and not lease it to the mining companies, but he actually said, what good does it do for me to keep my 50 acres if the trucks are going to go right by here and they're going to be mining within, you know, right here and everything around me? I'm going to be like an oasis or a pinnacle in this vast, destructive area. And that brings out the individual quandary and his own, and you brought that out very well in the film. I'm not going to ask you to tell what happened, but maybe you could speak a little more to his dilemma.
No, I think we can basically say what happened, because everyone's always curious. I mean, of course, go see the film later when it's out. But really what happened was that Beverly filed a petition with her neighbors to declare their watershed unsuitable for mining. So she wanted to flat out stop mining within her community. And then Terry started, as he was trying to work with the coal company, they started sort of backing away from him. And then they started using the very language that Beverly had put into her petition, basically turning it back on him and saying, no, we can't mine in your place anymore because your land is unsuitable for mining. So he wasn't actually a holdout. He was still teeter-tottering, and it really came down to, like, he didn't get the chance to make that decision, and I think he might be kind of glad about that because it was a pretty hard one to make, whether he was going to have the little thumbnail of land, as he always describes it. He likes to hold up his thumb next to the map and show you that it really is just the size of a thumbnail in comparison to the size of the mine. But in the end, he didn't really get to make that decision. So
yeah. So we always went back and forth, Jen and I, between would he sign, would he not sign. I mean, Terry just is a very contrary person. That's his identity. You know, when he talks about in the movie, I don't think it was in the clip, but how he's been inspired by William Blake, Thomas Jefferson. I mean, he's just the definition of a libertarian in this country and does not want to be controlled. So you never know. We never knew would he sign or not. You know, and in the end, the mining company just stopped coming. He drove too hard of a bargain and was educated and literate, which I think is part of that puzzle there, and they just stopped coming.
Could you also speak to the individual who are trying to stop or not lease their land's relationship to people in the community who work for the coal companies and drive the trucks and that kind of thing?
It's definitely contentious. I mean, we filmed several community hearings where it was basically like a room like this where it's divided into two sections of chairs, and when all the miners come in, they come in on one side and they sit on one side with their caps on and everything. And, you know, they don't have mining company paraphernalia on or anything, but you know what's going on. And then the community members come in and they all put their buttons on and stuff, the people who are trying to fight against the mines, and they kind of sit on the other side. So as you walk into a room, you have to make that decision right then and there, which side are you going to sit on? And that is still tough for many people because their cousins, their brothers, their parents, their relatives, their friends work for the mines. So they don't necessarily want to make that kind of decision where they're for or against. There are people who still, even though they're living with it, see the complexities of it and the economics also.
Yeah. It's so interesting, too, how the stories evolve, because I think for a long time this was sort of, and even now in our sort of, we're at rough cut stage with the film, this conversation right now, this sort of question about people's dilemma in the community, whether or not to sign, whether you work for the coal company or not, or you're an activist, should you sign or not, was, you know, the major driving sort of backstory force of interest in the film. And I think as we've sort of like been massaging the story down, one of the things that's emerging as sort of an offshoot of this is really the question of what happens to a community, what is the impact on a community, both short and long term, when its people are forced to destroy the very mountains and watersheds that make it up. And also, why, after so long, 150 years of coal mining in the region, are these people still dependent on coal? Why is that the crux of the economy? And what's great about that, as sort of the offshoot of all this other stuff we were talking about, is that really these are questions. There aren't any answers here. And to be left with these powerful big picture questions makes for a very rich story.
I don't have the statistics, but what hasn't the percentage of people employed by the coal industry gone down with mountaintop removal? Do you have those numbers?
Yeah, I just remember one statistic from Kentucky, and that was that there were something like 100,000 people employed about 20 years ago in the mining industry, and that went down to something like 20,000.
Yeah, 16,000.
Yeah.
16,000.
So yeah, I mean, as it gets more and more mechanized, the irony is that while people are still saying this is what provides the jobs here, the jobs are fewer and fewer every single year. And so when you have a machine that's the size of a football field, it's seven stories high, that, you know, a very small team of like four or five people can operate a drag line, and they can basically remove the top of a mountain, you know, over the course of a few weeks, really. I mean, there's not a lot of jobs there. There are a lot of jobs in related industries, water testing and engineering and the Army Corps of Engineers and all of that. So I don't want to say that it's there are no jobs or something like that, but it's definitely decreased rapidly.
Also, we talked about clear cutting to get the mountains bare so you could then remove the mountains, and where you put the all of the dirt that comes out of the removal. But there's one other issue, which is called sludge impoundment. Could you explain exactly what that is? It's another major environmental issue.
I think you're talking about the slurry impoundments.
Right.
Where
yes.
The mining
slurry. Slurry. Okay.
Yeah. Where the mining companies are just basically rounding up. I'm not even actually sure technically what happens where they channel the sludge, for lack of a better word, that comes out. You can tell.
Yeah, so basically when the rains come falling down and they soak up all these heavy metals, there becomes this really weird substance that's almost like a rubbery black sludge.
Cadmium, mercury, zinc, selenium.
Yeah, it's full of all kinds of horrible things, and those horrible things are not supposed to leak into the water supply. So what the mining companies have to do is create a giant thing that will hold that stuff, the sludge. And usually what they do is push up a bunch of earth, and they make an earthen embankment to contain all the sludge. But you can imagine, so let's say the contract for the mine goes for a certain period of time, 20 years or something like that. After that 20-year mark, the land often reverts back to like the state. So now this giant thing that is supposed to contain that water and that sludge and hold it back forevermore is now extremely vulnerable. And as the rains keep coming down, this is why you've probably heard of some of these disasters that take place. A lot of them are named after the creeks that end up getting completely flooded and all the homes that end up getting flooded with all this coal slurry.
Yeah, he was talking about it a little bit here with the two guys sitting at the table where, you know, there's this giant sponge on top of the mountains, and he was saying what happens when one of these 10-year floods comes. This is what they're referring to, that the mountains can just sort of collapse off into when they'll sort of clear-cut the mountains before mining, and they'll just bury those trees in a pit. But, of course, the trees being organic matter just break down, and pretty soon you have not a very solid ground that's the top of your mountain over these communities. So they just give way.
Yeah, there's a famous slurry pond that someday is probably going to give way, and we'll all be in our lives, and we'll hear about it on the news. What's the
Marsh
school?
Marsh
Fork Elementary School. You may have even read or heard about it already, but it's a little elementary school that's sitting at the base of this gigantic earthen mound with a slurry pond on top of it. So someday that's going to give way, and if the kids are in school that day, they're all going to die. I mean, it's basically, I've flown over it and looked at it from the air and just was gasping and probably crying at the same time while trying to shoot.
We have a couple of questions here, somewhat about the economic class issues. How much are these people given to lease their land, and what kind of coverage do they have in terms of health care, those kind of issues? And I think there is what kind of contracts do the residents sign? Exactly
it
what
really varies. I mean, we definitely can't give one set answer. We do know that everyone in this community, we've been filming in this one county, and of everyone that we know, the person who has gotten the most money got $10,000 from a mining company. So it's not a lot of money. And that's something I really hope that we can bring into the film so that people get that. And in terms of, you know, and often, I mean, this is part of the work that Kentuckians for the Commonwealth is doing, which is going around educating the people in these communities about their rights, because many of them either can't read or want a new car. I mean, like you saw here, there's sort of the short-term gain, long-term pain kind of subtext here. Many of them don't have health insurance. A lot of the people living here are living off of a government check of some sort, whether it's disability, often disability for some reason or another. So, you know, the economic issues are pretty rife in the film. The leases, we've looked through a lease. They're not very long. They're several pages. And usually what happens is the mining companies will come and sort of ask for everything and offer a lot of money up front. And, you know, if people sort of start to negotiate, the mining company will go away and then come back and offer less, you know, and then go away and come back and offer less. So the idea is that they sort of get people hooked and people want to sign, but the longer they wait, the less money they're promised.
One of the tricks in terms of the signing of the lease too is just that sometimes, like I mentioned, people will sign what they think is one thing, but they'll end up with another. And so one of those things is that the coal company will come tell them that they have a bunch of coal on their land. So sign right here, and you'll get 50 cents a ton or a dollar a ton for each ton of coal that's hauled off of your land. But it turns out that the coal seam ends just before their property, and somewhere in the lease, in the fine print, it says that they can use their property for any purpose related to mining, including dumping. And so that's how they can get basically someone's backyard turned into a giant valley fill where they're just dumping mine waste. So they may never see a dime, because the transaction was about, if you actually have coal here and the coal is mined from your property, you will get 50 cents a ton for each ton that's mined. If there's no coal there, they can use it as a dumping ground, and that's what they do, and then that's free for them.
And so, although some of us sometimes think this is isolated, these streams that are being destroyed are often the headwaters of water supply systems flowing down towards the Atlantic. So it's not that isolated in terms of the long-term and greater damage that it's doing. I have a number of questions about coal companies. Some of these, I think, will be general answers. Now, I've heard that about 50% of our energy in America does come from coal. So we are talking about a major source of energy. Not only that, but when you think about how strong the lobbyists are about coal, think of the railroads who depend on coal. That's their biggest cash customer. So you have a very strong push to use coal. Somebody asked, and I'm not sure we up here can answer this question, about government subsidies for coal companies. Do we know about if there are subsidies for coal companies?
I don't know about subsidies particularly, but definitely lax in the regulation department, which could be considered a type of subsidy.
I also think I heard that, I'm not an expert in this, but I think I heard that coal has the largest lobbying in Washington.
That would make sense.
Recently, like this was just a couple weeks ago.
There was also talk of the coal companies going after some of the green dollars to study clean coal, which is basically a fallacy.
Okay.
For our radio audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. And our guests today, Patricia Adams, Sally Rubin, and Jen Gilliman, discussing mountaintop coal mining. We'll continue with the questions. We urge you to ask them. We're really interested in what you wish to ask and get information about. When we get to the last question, I'll tell you. How's that? But for our radio audience, we will continue with our questions now.
Do you have any idea how many mining companies there are mining in the Appalachian area?
It's a pretty complicated question because there's a whole hierarchy. There's about five giant companies, and then they have many, many subsidiary companies, and often those subsidiary companies change names with each mine site that they create. It's an easy way for them to not be tracked and not be held accountable for what they've done when they've moved on. So I have no idea.
Yeah, but one of the things that's important to note is that the mining company featured in the film, they're called Miller Brothers Coal. They are a local company, and a lot
owned
of the people
owned by a giant one.
Owned by a giant out-of-state company, and so you have guys working for Miller Brothers who went to high school with our main subjects, and their sort of mothers are still friends, and there's a lot of There's a lot of strife often within the community because people are sort of on either sides of the fence. And, of course, this is also featured in the film, is what happens when these companies go bankrupt and don't have to make good on their bonds, and then another company comes in and just buys up, and they're bought up by another company.
This fact that Sally just said underscores the fact that a very large percentage, I've heard up to 70, but I'm not sure that's true, percent of the private land in West Virginia is owned by out-of-state individuals or companies. So it almost makes it almost a feudal situation, that the big lands are not owned by the local people. But if we don't use coal, what are we going to use? And what about the economy in these communities if you're not going to continue mining? And it doesn't seem likely they're going to go back to deep mining.
There is still a lot of deep mining happening, actually. They're just going at it from all angles at the same time. Sometimes there's a mountain where it's being surface mined on one side and deep mined on the other. So that's still happening, but I think it's a multi-pronged approach. I mean, there has to be development of alternative energies. There has to be that happening in Appalachia where some of the jobs, particularly with the Green Jobs Initiative, like some of those jobs can result in new employment and new industries developing in Appalachia. And we all have to consume less energy and seek those alternative forms of energy wherever possible.
Yeah, a lot of the talk in Appalachia around alternative energy is wind energy, and in particular, putting wind turbines on these reclaimed mountain mines. There are people working on that. It sounds like it's going to be a long time before that's really happening in any major way, but that's what's seen as the most obvious answer there, especially because it would employ people, you know, give people jobs and put some use to those mountains.
There is an argument that rather than doing mountaintop removal, put the wind turbines there in the first place, that it would create more energy and not destroy the mountains.
Yeah,
and in some cases, it's like to produce the same amount of energy, if the coal company would just go buy everybody a refrigerator, a low energy consuming Energy Star refrigerator, they would spend less money to mine the coal to produce that electricity. But it's part of this gigantic system, so it's really hard for one individual to get outside of that system.
Yeah. But part of the nice thing about being sort of in the role that we are in terms of making this film is we've always felt like, okay, it's our job to impact people on an emotional level, inspire them to feel like, okay, maybe what I do here in California has an effect on other people somewhere else, people in Appalachia, a region that matters. And then we're partnering with all of these wonderful organizations, I Love Mountains, Appalachian Voices, Natural Resources Defense Council, and, you know, all these different organizations who have the infrastructure to be able to help to get people into action, to actually create change. So we sort of decided a long time ago, okay, we'll be responsible for moving people and getting people inspired, and then we'll work with partners who can help to really get people into action.
This question goes back to the slurry and the health impacts of the slurry. And are people, are they noticing effects in their local water? And I think you probably showed this in the film, which wasn't part of the clip. How is the slurry and the mining affecting people who live in the hollers?
Yeah. Almost no one drinks the water anymore. It's all city water, pretty much. And the irony there is that a lot of the people working on the coal mining sort of side say, well, mountaintop removal is providing jobs because we have people who are coming in and we're cleaning the water. So that's always sort of funny. But yeah, you almost can't drink the water there. And beyond just the water, it's poisoning the soil. Many people can't eat their vegetables, especially after a big rain, which happens a lot in Appalachia. So it's a big problem.
Yeah, so if you picture the difference between water falling down on a giant ecosystem of trees and all that water getting absorbed into the soil and then feeding the trees and feeding all of us, the difference between that and the water falling down on a giant open cavern of exposed heavy metals and rock, and then where that water goes, it's going to go somewhere. It's going to trickle down into the water supply everywhere. So it's probably in the water we're drinking right now one way or another.
This question is, how can mountaintop removal even be legal? And can one of you speak to the Bush administration's change in the law with EPA and the fill and the waste?
Yeah, so there was in the Clean Water Act, there used to be a provision that basically said that you couldn't, there, it was called the stream buffer zone. You couldn't mine within 100 feet of any freshwater stream, and there were some little caveats to that, like if it was, it had to be running for a certain amount of time each year. And so the Bush administration just kind of took that piece out to make it a lot easier for companies to mine, because now they didn't have to worry anymore about where the streams were. They could just mine straight through the streams, across the streams, dump things into the streams, kind of do whatever they want to do. So it made a lot easier to do mountaintop removal mining. So now there is a movement. Hopefully Obama will really take this charge up, but to put that provision back into the Clean Water Act. And then there are a couple other federal things happening, not directly related to that, but there's a thing called a nationwide permit, which basically, it's Nationwide Permit 21, and it basically allows a company to apply for a giant waiver to be able to dump things into streams and to contaminate the stream. So
the other statistics, it's in your sheet. It's on one of the fact sheets that's on your chairs. And it's about, it sort of gives the timeline of how mountaintop removal really came to be legal. I mean, that's a great question. How is mountaintop removal legal, and then how are these valley fills legal, where we've filled in, I think it's 1,200 miles of streams now. And it talks about how in, I think it was 2001, the Clean Water Act was passed, and meaning we weren't allowed to dump waste in any of the watersheds of the United States. And mining waste was one of those things that was considered waste. But then several years ago, that was changed and said that actually mining waste isn't considered waste, so you can fill up in the streams. And that's when a lot of the hundreds and hundreds of miles of streams were buried with mine waste.
Another big point to the whole legality of it is there's this thing called the approximate original contour. And companies, mining companies, if they do mountaintop removal mining, are supposed to return the land to its approximate original contour. Beverly, actually, that was one of the winnings that she had in her petition, was that the judge said, oh, we're not going to say that you can't mine here at all, but you can't get a waiver. You have to return the land to the approximate original contour, which usually the companies are just granted waivers for that. So technically, mountaintop removal is illegal. However, they always get waivers for this approximate original contour thing, which means that you can leave it like a big flat chasm and you don't have to return the mountains back to the way it was.
Now explain these waivers. Are they state or EPA, federal?
Yeah, the ones related to water are usually federal, and then the nationwide permit one is definitely federal.
But Beverly's was local.
Yeah, that was a state. That was state. The state of Kentucky. I mean, it was for just for her watershed, but they were speaking to the State Office of Surface Mining. So it's complicated. There's about four permits that each mining company needs to get before they open a new mine.
Someone has asked about your interviewing mine company owners.
Mm-hmm.
I know you did say you talked to people that lived in the community,
yeah,
that worked for the mines.
We tried and tried. And we have a couple $100 on my phone bill from calling information and pursuing the mining companies when we were down there. They just couldn't talk to us. You know, it wasn't even that they didn't want to. Anyone who worked from any of the mining companies risked losing their job. So what we did do ultimately was we were able to spend the day with a mining engineer who actually happened to be an old friend of Terry's. And that was very, very interesting. And what you actually see in the film is sort of the fruits of that day. He shows us how they engineer a mine, what some of the factors are. We actually go to a reclaimed mine site, which is great because you see what can come of reclaiming the mountain mines. So that's in the film. Beyond that, largely the pro-mining voice comes through in these various meetings. You sort of hear these speeches, many of which are really articulate and heartfelt. But that was definitely one of the challenges in the film, was being able to really bring in that other side to the extent we wanted to.
Did you speak to the senators from Kentucky or from West Virginia and those politicians' stance on their support or non-support?
No. I mean, I think it's really important to, depending on what type of film you're doing, to do that kind of exhaustive thing. We were really just following this one story in this one community. So if a senator had come to town, we definitely would have been there. But since they weren't, we were really just dealing with these people and the people around them and what they were dealing with. So.
Yeah.
Now, I understand that Floyd, Kentucky is near Hazard, which has been in the 70s. Harry Caudill wrote the book, Night Comes to the Cumberlands. And so this is not a new issue. That was an issue about strip mining in that era. And I think John Kennedy was there and Robert Kennedy was there in Kentucky and promised to work on this issue. And it seems in a way to have dropped off the radar screen in the last 30 years, this part of America. They talk about some of the slurry impoundments that broke through and did enormous damage, which was three times as great as Valdez. But I never heard about it. And do you, in working down there, do you have a, talking to the people, do you have a theory of why this part of the our country has been sort of put in the back closet and the door closed?
I have a theory that probably sounds like a conspiracy theory. I think probably all of you think this too, but to me it seems like if when you're taking advantage of a region and the people that live there to humanize and value and respect them, makes you feel bad about what you're doing. And we're all responsible. I mean, we're the ones who are in here with these lights on. I don't know if these are green lights or what. I assume they're just sort of standard lights. They look like maybe compact fluorescents. But anyway, you know, I think it's just, it's easier to put people down when you need something from them that's exploiting them in the land. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think it might be also just the control that the coal companies do exert and how difficult it is to overcome that and to break out of that and to for the community members that are busy in their day-to-day trying to have their jobs, fight the mining company, and then to also be submitting press releases and trying to get the word out about what's happening to them. I mean, that's why organizations like NRDC, Sierra Club, and Kentuckians for the Commonwealth exist, but and they do a great job. But it takes people getting interested also and really being concerned about how their choices are affecting other people.
Well,
I think it's hard, too, because I think that we've even found this, that there's this sort of smokescreen effect that happens around Appalachia where if you haven't been there and you don't know anyone from there and all you've ever seen are the movies and read the books that most of us have read, really, about the region, it takes a long time to sort of crack through that. And that's one of the challenges here, too, is trying to get people to relate to these people in the region as something that's real. It isn't just some, you know, sort of hokey-looking banjo shots on screen. These are real people with real lives. So that's always that. I think that answers this question about...
Felicia, would you come up? I want to ask you to speak to... NRDC is partnering with you on this movie and also has a program that and a campaign that they have started to not just bring awareness to this issue but actually take specific action. And Felicia Marcus is an NRDC representative and can speak to that better than I can. And just to, so when you ask, what is being done? Terry's daughter who said, I'm just one person. What can I do? It's really discouraging. Am I just going to whine and say, why poor me? Well, I think it's important to know there is something being done by a group outside of Appalachia as well, because this is, as I started out saying, it's a bigger issue than just a local regional issue.
Okay, I'll be brief to return to the panel, and folks can go to our website at nrdc.org and get more information. But we've been working on a campaign with the local groups in Appalachia very closely with a number of the groups, including the one Sally mentioned, to try and raise the visibility of this issue. Years ago, the Kennedys both went there. People saw it more vigorously. Jimmy Carter tried to reform the Surface Mining Act. They eventually did, but even he felt that it wasn't enough. And so we're trying to raise the visibility of this issue across the country so that it isn't the invisible issue that we were just talking about. A number of things are happening. There was a push recently in the Obama administration to try and tighten up some of these issues. That nationwide Permit 21 that Jen mentioned was really an appalling situation where around the country, EPA was very involved in overseeing where the Corps of Engineers permits for these matters, where it was very difficult to dump things in a river, lake, or stream, a whole process of review, environmental impact studies, public comment, the ability for EPA to veto a permit or raise it up to a higher level of visibility. And by making it a streamlined national permit, it was almost like a rudimentary ministerial action to approve these, and they are moving to having at least individual review of these permits. Our ultimate goal is to stop this practice, which is devastating to communities as well as to the environment. So it's a long-term crusade. Nashville, country stars are getting involved. There'll be concerts, which seems to be the time-honored practice. And so if you go to our website, you can hear more about it. There are baby steps. We were saying there's sort of tennis applause for the initial steps from the Obama administration, but a lot more needs to be done.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We'll wind up with two questions. First of all, this is a question about, well, how can we as individuals help to change this on a daily basis? What small daily changes can I make in how I live to use less electricity, which is a great question. And then finally, if you would wrap up, where the film stands now, when we will be able to see it.
Yeah. Do you want to do the first
sure.
one?
So there's a lot of things you can do to use less electricity. I mean, energy-efficient appliances, compact fluorescent light bulbs, those are kind of like the easiest ones. And then actually being really conscious of when you leave things plugged in. People don't realize that a lot of times when you leave your chargers all plugged into the wall and you just kind of plug your phone in and out of them, like that's still sucking power out of the wall. So you're using all this phantom power in your houses that you may not realize. Get one of those little devices that help you track your energy use on a day-to-day basis and then actually follow it. It's if we could all just work together to reduce the peak demand, we would do a lot to save the amount of coal that needs to be burned just to meet peak demand, because power plants are kind of like hungry beasts, but they're also stupid ones. They don't have any way to regulate and change the flow and consume and burn less coal just to meet the demand. So they just have to go and operate to try to meet with peak capacity. So there's also a bunch of stuff. Our website is deepdownfilm.org. There's like 10 easy tips how you can make a difference, that kind of thing. So please check that out.
Yeah, I think also, too, I mean, this sounds hokey, but you can connect people to Appalachia. You can certainly connect people to the film and other efforts coming from this region. That's important that we know where the power is coming from. That'll definitely make an impact. Yeah, we just wanted to let you all know where the film is at right now. It's been 2.5 years we've been filming. We've shot almost 250 hours of film, and we've been editing since March. We're sort of nearing the end of post-production. We're at rough cut. It's amazing to say. The film will be complete in September. And beginning to broadcast regionally, so in Kentucky and potentially into some of the other states there on PBS beginning in the fall. And we're hoping for a national PBS broadcast next year. It would be either on one of the national documentary strands or put out to regional and local PBS stations to pick up and show for a period of 4 years ongoingly. We'll also be having community screenings and submitting it to festivals this fall. So it will be available for viewing. And several of our outreach efforts, we just wanted to mention this really quickly too. We're working with regional teachers to develop different types of curriculum using the film. We really, really, it's always been important to us to sort of get the film used and in action as quickly as we possibly could. We're also partnering with the organizations, as we mentioned, and one of our coolest pieces is a virtual mountain mine, where we're creating in Second Life, actually, a virtual reality mountaintop removal mining game. So not only students, but people will be able to go in there and basically role play as a miner or whoever you choose and get to make decisions about how you're going to power your town. So we're sort of trying to use traditional storytelling efforts that can impact people emotionally with new and innovative ways of actually reaching people.
And we are still fundraising, so if anyone wants to make a donation, please do so. That will go directly to help us do some of this curriculum and outreach efforts that we're going to do with the film this fall.
Thank you, Jen and Sally, and I'd like to finish sort of where I started off. This is not just a local Appalachian issue. Mining is an issue in much of the United States, including now Pennsylvania and New York, with the discovery of natural gas. And landsmen are coming in that part of the world, also trying to get leases for land, which will turn the rural areas into industrial sites. And I know it's true in Colorado and Idaho. It's not a single issue, and that's the reason I think we all need to learn about it and address this issue in whatever way we can. And I'll turn it back over to you, Ann.
And I want to thank you for coming. I want to also assure you that the Commonwealth Club is very dedicated to the environment and green. I have to give a plug because I worked for the saving of the Tuolumne River, and the water you drink at the in San Francisco and here at the Commonwealth Club is actually Tuolumne River water, and we were able to protect the river. In addition to that, we have a very robust program called Climate One, which really continually addresses the issues of global warming. And for those of you who would like to join us, the Environment and Natural Resources Forum is open to anyone who wants to come and help us plan programs for the Commonwealth. So if you would like to be involved and you see areas that you really think need to be addressed, there is a wonderful committee. Volunteers are here from the committee tonight helping us. And you will, I promise you, you will like them. They're just wonderful to work with. So, yes, we are very dedicated at the Commonwealth Club. Our thanks to Patricia Adams, Sally Rubin, and Jen Gellman for their discussion of the soon-to-be-released documentary Deep Down with the Appalachian Coal Mining. We'd also like to thank our audiences that are on radio and in the Internet. Again, I'm Ann Clark, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.